Welcome, welcome friends to ArtCast. I'm your host, Ron Jacobs, coming to you once again with architecture wisdom from the fount that is BS Live San Francisco, where I had a great time talking to many of the speakers there. And on today's show, we are going to hear from, well, the guru of business objects, Rockford Lotka, or Rocky, as we like to call him, as in Bullwinkle and Rocky. No, just kidding. Just kidding. I'm sure he's heard that a million times. So Rocky is the author of Expert Visual Basic.net and C-Sharp Business Object books, which are really just terrific stuff. Speaks at many conferences around the world, and just an all-around good guy who's passionate about helping you to do the right thing with objects. Stop putting all that code in your UI. That's a bad idea. Let's give it up for Rocky Lotka. Hi, this is Ron Jacobs, and I am here at VS Live with Rocky Lotka, who is one of the amazing VS Live speakers, fresh in from the cold north of Minneapolis. Or was it cold there?
It was not cold there. We've had an unusually warm winter.
You're kidding me.
No, 57 degrees a couple days ago.
That is so bizarre. I'm sure like all the global warming people are going, see, I told you.
Well, and what's funny, so I fly into San Francisco, it's 55. So it's warmer in Minnesota than San Francisco in January.
That is freaky, truly freaky. Well, you know, and it had to be like raining here. It has rained almost every day for the last 6 weeks in Seattle. So I'm really getting annoyed. I come to sunny California and it's raining here too. But what can you say? So, all right. But we are here at the most wonderful event in the world, of course, VS Live. And you do a lot of the VS Live events, don't you?
I do most of them. Yep. Mm-hmm. And really enjoy it. A lot of the people that attend it have come back many, many times or even fly here from all over the world. It's just a good conference and a lot of fun people.
Yeah, I've done a bunch of these. I think I did four or five of them in the last year, and I missed a few. You know, I didn't go to Vegas. Did you go to Vegas?
No, I did not.
Oh, see, well, that's... we missed the fun one. Because you know what they say about Vegas, right? Well, anyway, we don't want to go there because, you know, my wife might be listening. So, anyway, I didn't go, really. All right, but what are you talking to the folks here at VS Live about this week?
Well, mostly I'm talking about object-oriented design and building distributed systems using objects.
Okay, and isn't that like ancient history now? Haven't we all figured this out by now?
Well, you would think so. Uh-huh. Everybody wants to use objects, in fact, if you're not using an object-oriented language like VB or C#, in .NET, or then bad you, right?
Yeah, right. You're really lame, man. You're way out.
As we said, I speak at a lot of these conferences around the world, and I will often ask the audience that I'm speaking to how many people use object-oriented design in their daily work. Mm-hmm. In other words, they sit down to build a system. Do they really use object-oriented design to design their system? And only about 30% typically say that they do. So that means well over half of the people in the audience are not using object-oriented design to build their applications.
Well, that's kind of scary because it makes me wonder, if they're not using object-oriented design, what are they doing?
Well, Microsoft has this really cool object called a data set. And the data set lets you go to the database, get all of the data you want into a nice tabular container, and then you can write all of your code, behind the UI, actually. Because if you look at both Windows forms and web forms, again, Microsoft has done this really nice job of having a real rich eventing model and nice RAD tools. So you can just jump in, double-click on a button, and there comes a code window. Right? Now, this used to be called VB3 style coding, right? but now that you could do the same thing in C#, and most people do, I suppose it's just RAD development, maybe.
So you look in that code behind file, open the button click handler, and you find 10,000 lines of code that... go off and do a bunch of stuff and connect to databases and deal with data sets. And so you're using an object-oriented language, and you have methods and that you're doing, but really not getting into breaking down into the kind of business objects that you've become known for being like the business objects guy. How did you get known as that anyway?
Well, I guess over the last decade or so, I've been writing books and speaking largely on this topic. This is what I get excited about, right? This is my area of passion. And I really am driven, I think, because this model that we're talking about of writing all of this code behind the UI is a flawed model. Mm-hmm. And everybody seems to know that it's a flawed model, but it's not always clear how to do something else. And you know, it's so easy to do, you know, put the code behind the UI, and you say, well, you shouldn't do that. And people say, well, yes, I know I shouldn't do that. And then, but how, right? Well, and objects offer an answer. And I think this is the real key.
Speaking of books, I had this idea the other day that, I saw in the news of this whole big controversy about this guy who wrote the book, The Million Little Pieces, and he was on Oprah, and his book was featured in the Oprah Book Club. And I thought, well, if Oprah can have a book club, I should have a book club. I'm going to have Ron's ArtCast Book Club. And, you know, so in maybe in your next book, if it's good, then it might make my book club list. So we'll see about that. Okay.
Well, I hope it's good. It should be out at the end of March. So, it'll be coming up soon.
Yeah. And then maybe all of the ArtCast listeners will go out and buy it and, it'll set sales records and make the top 10 list or whatever. Right. So that'd be cool.
That's what happens with Oprah, right? And these guys transforms their lives. So if you can transform my life, go for it.
Okay. As long as you promise not to lie in your book. Okay. All right, I've never written a book. I've written some magazine articles, but I can't sit still long enough to write a book. That must be tough.
It does require a lot of sitting, yes.
I get an idea and I go speak at a conference and write a blog post and make an article, and that's about as far as I get.
Well, it is true, right? Writing an article can take, a week, 2-3 weeks, in that range. And uh-huh. So it's a relatively achievable thing. Writing a book is more in the 6 to 10 month range. And so it's a pretty big commitment. And I think to write a book, it has to be something that you're passionate about doing. Because it's not, books don't make a whole lot of money either, unless you get on Oprah.
Yeah.
Right. But so it really is a labor of love, I think.
Okay, that is just twisted. you love objects that much, man. You're just like, oh, I totally love this.
I do. I'm sorry.
You are
true.
A geek, man. You are a big time geek. Well, that's okay. People love all kinds of weird things. So, getting back to this object design idea. I remember when I first learned C++. It was in the early 90s, and I was working here in Silicon Valley with a bunch of hardcore C programmers, and they brought in a instructor. We spent 2 weeks in a classroom, and these hardcore C guys had a very tough time. I mean, they could write some great C code, but we start talking about classes and inheritance and polymorphism, and they couldn't get it. But I had only been doing that for a couple of years, and so I got it pretty easy. It came right to me naturally. But we had this idea that we wanted to take everything in our system and convert it into objects, and things like customers and invoices and purchase orders and sales and everything. So we made a customer object, and then we thought, customers have invoices. So we'll have an invoice object, and when you go, I want my customer invoices, you go customer.invoices. blah, blah, blah. And so pretty soon you had customers.invoices.lineitems.this.that.the other thing. And then you find if you wanted to get a customer object, just because you want to display their address and you don't care about the invoices, you go up to get the customer object. It takes like 3 minutes, and later you get back this huge object with everything you ever might ever want to know about a customer, and you were done. But didn't work so well.
No, it doesn't. but I think everybody starts there. I think it's natural because all of us spend so much time working with data and understanding how databases work and ER diagrams and, you know, and then we start describing objects often in terms of entities. And so you say, well, a customer object is a customer entity, and then the customer table in the database is a customer entity. And so maybe everything becomes defined by data. And I think that's fundamentally flawed. And I say this, I was where you were. Right?
Yeah.
I mean, I've been there. I've done all those things too, right? And you run into these roadblocks. And the answer, I believe, is that objects are defined by behavior. And so when you sit down to create your object model, you should, as much as possible, ignore the data, because that's not the important part. And instead, you should focus on what's the object, what's it supposed to do? So your customer object, it has a mission in life, so to speak, right?
Mm.
And it should be a clearly defined mission. And I say this because, you know, if you think about you or I, if you come into work in the morning, and you've got 18 different things to do with conflicting priorities, that's stressful, right? And it's not fun. And versus if you come in to work in the morning and you've got one assignment, very clear priorities, there's a lot less stress and a lot more focus. Now, in an object, that quote-unquote stress really translates into convoluted or complicated code. So if you look at a customer object that's designed to do 18 different things, that looks like a lot of switch or select statements. It looks like a lot of if-then, you know, conditional branching code. And you can't just look at the object and say, ooh, I know what it does, right? You have to trace the code in order to figure out, well, in this case it does this, and in this other case it does that. Well, shoot, at that point, you could have just stuck with C, right, or Fortran, or you know, I mean, we can write spaghetti code in any of those languages just as well.
Well, so if I'm going to write some objects then, and I'm not going to start with data, how do I approach that? You know, I guess I'm thinking about the customer object's mission in life. Well, what is that? I mean, I suppose it wants to make sure that it's got correct and up-to-date data. So if the real customer that it represents out in the world moved, a human needs to tell it what the new address is, so it probably wants to make sure that the database that stores its durable state would be up-to-date, and maybe it, I don't know. What other things would a customer object live for?
That might be it.
Okay.
You know, really, all these, an object's mission in life should come from a use case. Or if you're agile, it would be a story, right?
Yeah, all right.
And so you sit down with your, you know, business users or stakeholders, you know, the end users that understand the business itself, and you say, well, what do you need your system to do? And one of the things they might say is, well, we need to maintain our customer data. You say, well, okay, so tell me how you do that, right? What are the different stories or use cases? Well, we sometimes need to add customers, sometimes customers move, so we need to update their address and so forth. And you go through this process of collecting their story, and then you decompose it. Any form of object design ends up going through this decomposition process where you try to identify what are the, I suppose actors is a good word, the actors in the system, and then what do they do? And so customer might become an actor, but in this case, then the customer's responsibility or mission in life, as you say, would presumably be to record valid customer data.
So this is, you know, of course they taught us back in school, you know, you take the nouns, those are the objects, and the verbs are the methods, you know.
and that's a totally wonderful technique as a starting point, but you kind of flow from there. And, but you know, just kind of flowing with this customer thing, the next thing that you're going to find out is that you need to get a list of customers, right? Because the end user, if we're going to edit a customer, we have to find the one we want to edit. So now you need a list of customers, and you know, you might say, oh, well, I've got this customer object. I'll just create, you know, we got generics, right?
Yeah.
So I'll create a list of customer, populate it, and there I go, right? But how many fields of data are in your customer? well, it could be 100 or 200, right?
Right, right.
So loading a list of customer could be really expensive.
Especially if all you need to do is put the names in a combo box or something, you know?
That's exactly right. And you know, so, I mean, intuitively, we know this is dangerous.
Sure.
But if you step back and think about it again, behaviorally, the behavior of this customer object is to essentially collect valid customer data, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we're not collecting data, are we? We're displaying a list. So right. we would be misusing this object. It's like, you know, coming in and asking an employee who's assigned to do one job, you know, and say, oh, can you do this other job for a while?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't know how to do that other job. Well, do it anyway. You know, it's better if you hire another employee to do the other job. Right? And in this case, it's better to create a customer display or a customer info object whose mission in life is to display a subset of customer data. Right? Totally different mission, totally different behavior. Now, the interesting thing, and this is where things get really fun, is they both have the same data, don't they?
Yeah, right? Yeah. See, that kind of rankles some object-oriented people. You know, they go, oh, that shouldn't happen.
Well, and this, I think, reflects how relational data theory has infected the object design world. Mm-hmm. I use the word infected.
And it's contagious.
You can tell where my bias lies.
Well, you know, that's a real interesting perspective. So what you're saying is that sometimes our tendency is to begin with the database and kind of look at the database and see how it modeled the world, in even borrowing its normalization concepts and all of that, and saying, right. Well, that seems to work pretty well there, and so we ought to make it, you know, our objects kind of similar, and it begins to break down. But it's kind of interesting how the inverse also happened, and that people flirted with the idea of, well, if objects are so great, why don't we have object databases?
Mm-hmm.
And
true.
They made those, and those kind of broke down too, didn't they?
Yes, because the object concepts don't seem to map well into efficient storage and retrieval of data.
Yeah.
I do think it's two different worlds. But, you know, what's kind of scary about this is most people use UML, or at least the class diagram scheme, out of UML when they do their object design. And if you take your database design and print it out, hang it on the wall. Right? You know, most people do this, right? But then take your object class diagram, print it out, hang it on the wall next to it, and take like two steps back. Can you tell the difference between them? They look the same, right? And so all of a sudden, it becomes crystal clear that our primary object design tool leads us to think about objects the way we think about database tables. And I think this is a problem. And so I'm a fan of CRC design instead, or class responsibility and collaboration, which is a very old, but unfortunately not very popular, scheme for doing object analysis and design.
So, well, okay, since it's so old and arcane, probably many of our listeners won't know what that means. So, a class responsibility collaboration. So the responsibility, is that like the mission in life of this thing, what it has to do?
That's how I portray it.
Uh-huh.
I think in classic CRC design, it's a little different, but the way I think about it is you define what you think is a class, so you give it a name, like customer or invoice, or customer list or something, and then you say, well, what is its mission in life? What's its responsibility? Which I think should be a, say, 6 to 8 word phrase. I mean, that keeps it focused, right? But again, we want happy objects, right?
We know no stressful objects out there. Yeah, no, okay.
Right, so you get a very clear, focused mission. And then when you start, one of the things that's kind of hiding behind that mission is that it will have behaviors. So in order to fulfill the mission, it's going to do certain actions. And you can kind of think of those maybe as methods or properties. But so it's got that aspect. But it also has collaborators, which are other objects that help it do its job. And so you can think of something like an invoice, which is relatively complex, or can be. And I've written an invoicing system years ago. and it was procedural. This was, you know, predates object orientation, at least in my experience.
You don't look that old, though.
I've been doing this almost 20 years.
Wow. Okay. So, yeah, I'm with you in that case. About the same. All right.
I think it's about the same time frame.
Okay. There. Yeah.
And so invoicing can be really, really complicated. And you can write an invoice object and put all that code in one place, and you could have an invoice object that's really, really complicated. And did you gain anything? No, nothing at all. But if you instead decompose the invoice process itself, then you can have a lot of smaller objects that the invoice collaborates with to calculate prices, to calculate discounts, to update the customer sales figures, all of the things that go into doing invoicing. But when you look at the invoice class, it ends up looking relatively simple.
You know, it's funny when you describe it that way, because it made me think about the whole reason why we went to object-oriented in the first place is because as programs became larger and larger and more complex, it's just like you'd get a buffer overflow when your brain tried to absorb what this thing does. You know, because you've only got so much brain workspace, right? and you can only understand so much of a problem at once. And so the big three of object orientation were polymorphism, inheritance, and encapsulation. And encapsulation was key because it helped you divide the problems up into mind-sized chunks.
Yes.
So if I could understand, I could look and focus on one aspect of the problem with a mind-sized chunk, because if the object was mind-sized, then I could do that. But once, you know, if I build the all-encompassing invoice object that could do every possible thing an invoice object needs to do, I'm right back to a buffer overflow of the brain because I can't understand that whole object at one time.
Yes, that's exactly right. And it's easy to lose sight of that because you think, I've got an object, and it starts out small and seems mind-sized, but then it grows slowly over time, and one day you wake up and your object has become a monster.
And you have to kill it. It must be killed.
Luckily, we have a trendy term to solve this, though, because now you can refactor your object.
Yes.
You see? And so now it's okay again because we have refactoring.
Well, that's when they go, wow, this code smells, man. We need to refactor that thing. You know, that reminds me of, Peter Provost and I did a webcast, and Brian Button, and they're big test-driven development type guys. And it's just amazing to watch them do this exercise about how they say, like, the code talks to them, you know. And it's just a way of saying, you know, as you're building the thing, you're kind of intuitively asking the question, does this object make sense? Has it overstepped its bounds? Is it getting too big? You know, is it duplicating functionality that really belongs somewhere else? And refactoring is just saying, I'm not afraid to change this. You know, break that object apart. Break it into 2 or 3 or 10 objects if you need to.
Yes, that's absolutely right. I mean, these concepts, I think, all dovetail together. And what I think is happening at the moment is that there's a resurgence. You know, I mentioned that CRC is quite old, but it has never been the big popular technique, right? But I think there's a resurgence. I think Agile and XP and test-driven development and the behavioral concept of objects all fit together in kind of a little world that at the moment is on the ascendancy. Right? People are interested and it's fun, and hopefully it will move the industry forward and let us build some cool software.
You know, it is interesting because when I think about I've done the little exercise where, you know, you're writing out these little cards and stuff with other people and sticking them all over the walls and, you know, checking everything out. But I actually even do that kind of mentally when I'm designing something, is I imagine, you know, the little objects, like, they've got names. Like, that's George, and that's Sally. And Sally does this, and when she needs to do that, she has to ask George to help with this part. And, mm-hmm. you know, and Sally knows what her name is, but George knows how to update the database or whatever. Right? Yeah, you know, so I kind of mentally think about them that way. I know it's scary to say that.
There's actually a word for that.
Yeah.
It's anthropomorphization, which is taking inanimate objects and giving them human attributes. Disney does this all the time, right? With like candelabras, and they dance around and, you know, sing songs. But it's a wonderful technique for doing behavioral object design because, you know, you can actually envision, is this object happy and is it social? Is it, you know, talking and playing well with others? And you can get some good laughs out of it because it's kind of corny, but it's useful.
But, you know, it also helps me to focus more on the behavior and collaborations rather than just the data. And the data the state that the object holds becomes like a supporting detail.
Yes.
An object holds whatever state it needs to do the behavior, but it shouldn't hold more.
That's right.
And then it needs to hold.
That's absolutely right. And similarly, then multiple objects might need some of the same data to do their job, but that's okay too. Right? And that's really the object relational mapping is often characterized as a way of loading data out of a table into an object that pretty much looks like the table. Right, and if that's all it is, that's kind of boring, right? But but if you start doing the object design that we're talking about here, then object relational mapping becomes truly interesting because the shapes of your objects can be quite different than the shapes of your data in your database, right? And you can have many objects using the same data, or a lot of interesting relationships that way.
Okay, so the last burning question. Service-oriented architecture. Now, people are going, we're not building objects anymore. We're building services. And we're passing around XML on the wire. And if we do have an object, it's just like a container for the data that we're pushing around. How do these concepts fit together?
Well, this is something I think about quite a bit. I mean, obviously, service orientation is also a very trendy, popular thing. And I've blogged about this a fair amount. And I think a lot of the problem that we face is actually based around language or semantics, in that you mentioned, we got this object and we'll send this across the network to a service, but that's not what's happening. Objects never go across the wire between services. Messages go across the wire between services. And there's this illusion that they're an object because when you're programming in VB or C#, we end up, you know, getting this proxy that's generated for us. But really what happened is that Visual Studio took the description of this message and created for us a quote-unquote object, which I think is maybe better characterized as a structure, because it's not an object. It has no behavior, right? It's just a container for data that's convenient for us to consume or create messages. And so services don't exchange objects. Now, on the other hand, you have to implement the service itself. Right? So if I'm sitting here writing a service, I'm going to accept a message from some outside source, and then I'm going to do some hopefully useful work and possibly produce a message in response. And the real question then is, how do I write the code that does that interesting work? And I might write that using linear programming techniques. I might use procedural programming techniques like we did in Pascal or C, or I might use object-oriented techniques in order to, again, create the body of this service. But what comes and goes is always just a message. It's just XML.
So really, you know, we're still doing objects, and we're just going to need objects on either side of the wire. And of course, sometimes people will say to me, well, okay, let's use our favorite customer object, you know. I've got the customer object on the server side, but then maybe I have a smart client application on the client side. I might want to have a customer object over there. Should I build one big customer object that lives on the server side and is also deployed on the client side? Is that a good idea?
Not if you're doing service orientation, no. And I draw this line because I personally still think that client-server technologies or some of the client-server concepts that we've explored over the last 10 or so years are totally valid. And if you're creating a client-server system where the server is part of the same application as the client, in other words, they're the same application, they just happen to have a network between them, then I'll go with you and say, yes, you could have the same customer object on both sides. And in fact, that's a lot of what I talk about in my business objects books. But if you're doing service orientation, then the mindset is entirely different. Because service orientation essentially says that anytime there's a network boundary, that you, at that point, have two applications. So instead of one application with tiers, now with service orientation, you have a server application, which could have many different consumers, one of which might be your client application that's the smart client. Well, now they can't share the customer object because they're not the same application. And so you don't want that dependency or coupling between the two. So the server needs to have its own customer object, its own internal implementation, and it consumes and sends messages that are following a clearly defined schema. And the consuming application, which is your smart client, is an entirely separate thing. It just happens to be calling a service, but its implementation really is its own business.
Well, and the other thing it seems to me is that the behaviors that you want at the server side and the client side are going to be different, right? I mean, you know, because on the server side, you might have a behavior like save yourself in the database, right? But on the client side, that wouldn't be valid at all because there is no database for the client side. All it has is call the service that saves you in the database or whatever, right?
Well, that's true, but it's a little dicey. And a lot of people will tend to look at service orientation as being a way of getting code reuse. And I think that's a flawed way of thinking about it, because you're right. You're on your server-side customer, certainly there's going to be code dealing with persistence. But remember that the server-side application is a standalone application, so it can't trust any consumer. So it's got to validate and all of the data coming in. And, of course, customer is a trivial example. But if you take a sales order or something else, it might have to recalculate taxes or because it can't assume that any of that was done right. Right? And then at the same time, your smart client that has this customer object, well, if it's a smart client, it needs a rich user experience and instant validation and so forth. Well, it's going to have to do validation and a variety of the same logic. And of course, it's different because it's going to support data binding and a bunch of things that the server one doesn't. But if you think about what I'm describing here, there is a large chunk of overlapping functionality. And yet they're separate objects. And so really, service orientation, if you look at it that way, is going to cause you to write duplicate code, just by definition.
Interesting. Well, that is fascinating stuff, and I look forward to your new book. And so, you know, now, see, if I, here's the problem. If I start a book club, I'm going to actually have to read some books so I can recommend them, or not. So, but I'm looking forward to reading it. Maybe you could send me a draft or something. Let me know.
We'll figure something out.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks, Rocky, for showing up.
Great. Well, thank you very much.
All right.
Rockford Lotka, ladies and gentlemen, business object guru, expert business object guy, right here on ArtCast. Hey, you know, there's so much to learn about this, and I'm so glad to have guys like Rocky around to give us wisdom on this. Hey, and I wanted to give a quick thanks to Robbie and Daniel from BT.com. Daniel says, hey, Ron, I just wanted to say, keep the ArtCast coming. They make a standing room commute every day into central London actually productive. Ha, that's the point. Send me a note to ron.jacobs@microsoft.com and let me know what you think. We'll see you next time on ArtCast.